Hello and welcome to the Access Point podcast series from Quintiles IMS. My name is John Doyle and I lead the Enterprise Solutions team in our Real World Insights organization. In this series, we will take an in-depth look at the latest issue of Access Point, our annual publication on current trends, insights, and advancements in real world evidence. In this issue, we focus on innovation, technologies, and methodologies that are pushing the boundaries of how evidence is being generated and applied across healthcare systems. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Stella Blackburn, Vice President, Global Head of Early Access and Risk Management, Real World Insights at Quintiles IMS. Stella recently authored an article in Access Point on adaptive pathways. Thank you for joining us today, Stella.
Thank you very much for inviting me, John. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
In your latest article, you discuss adaptive pathways, or this accelerated track to essentially bring innovative medicine to patients faster. Would you mind giving us a high-level primer on adaptive pathways and maybe just touch on the main objectives?
Yes, of course. Well, as we both know, drug development takes a long time from discovery of the molecule to when it actually becomes available for doctors to prescribe to patients outside of the clinical trials. And that is fine if you have a disease where there are lots of available treatments. But it's not so fine if you're a patient with a life-limiting disease and few or no treatment options. Adaptive pathways is a prospectively planned, innovative approach to bringing a medicine to market. And what it tries to do is to balance timely access for patients who have the most medical need with a need for ensuring that research continues on the benefits and risks of the medicine. So the premise behind adaptive pathways is that patients with the most unmet medical need might be willing to accept greater uncertainty about the benefits and the risks of a medicine in return for early access to it. As you get much more information and you reduce the uncertainties around the benefits and risks, then the access can gradually be expanded to a wider patient population, with the ultimate aim that eventually the medicine gets a full normal authorization. However, it's really important that all stakeholders are involved in the discussions and help in deciding what the evidence needs are for them all, and also what levels of uncertainty are acceptable, and also on the risk management. Also some key points behind the adaptive pathways. Now, the clinical trial program is primarily intended to show efficacy, and with virtually all medicines, knowledge about its safety profile and how it performs in the real world, its effectiveness, comes after it's marketed. So this is what we call real-world evidence as opposed to the ivory towers of clinical trials. So what adaptive pathways is actually doing is explicitly acknowledging these limitations and prospectively and iteratively planning to fill in the gaps and reduce uncertainties. It's much more of a continuous development plan.
And thank you for that, Stella. And if you're kind of dialing back the clock as a drug developer earlier in development to think through this continuous evidence generation plan, and what are some things that pharma companies can be doing in anticipation of adaptive pathways?
I think probably the key thing about it is the prospective planning. At the moment, a lot of drug development is done in silos. You have people who are looking to do the initial things, proving efficacy. You have the safety team who are thinking about ways of developing the safety profile and getting knowledge about it, including the risk management plan. You have usually a separate group who are looking at what evidence you need for market access, what the different stakeholders in the health technology assessment bodies and the payers actually want before they will say, hey, fine, we're happy to pay for the drug. And if companies actually start bringing all these different groups of people together, including patients, to find out what it is about a disease that most troubles them, you could actually plan a much more holistic development plan.
Yeah, I could see how that integrated approach can really drive more value for all stakeholders, including the patients that you mentioned. Just also thinking about your commentary in looking at the difference between RCTs and clinical development and real-world evidence generation. Stella, you touch on this balancing act, if you will, between internal and external validity, or looking at the efficacy of a product in a RCT environment versus the real-world effectiveness of a product in the clinic. Help us understand how a pharma company can balance these two needs in terms of bringing a product to market that's going to maximize benefit and minimize risk for patients.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think one of the key things is thinking about who your target population is, because we all know that there are limitations of clinical trials and that the patients in your typical clinical trial aren't very much like the patients that are going to be treated in the real world. They are patients who tend to be more in the middle age ranges. You get less of the very young and the very old. You get patients who are usually not having the most severe forms of the disease. You have patients who don't have many other diseases and aren't taking a whole load of medications. In fact, sometimes companies really don't have a very close idea of what the disease pathway is, and they don't know what their typical patient is in terms of what else they may have. So I think one of the key points would be to actually have a really good understanding of the epidemiology of the disease that you're interested in at the time that you start your drug development, so that you know really how the patient's journey is. But another thing you've touched on is how do you balance the need for access to the benefits and risks. And I think that's probably one of the key things that the critics have said about adaptive pathways. Some people have said that it's just a lowering of standards so that the pharmaceutical industry can get away with a lot less research. And I think that really is an unfounded concern. Other concerns are that the industry will not do the research once it's got a drug on the market. But then again, this has been a concern for a very long time, and I think all of us would acknowledge that in the early stages, companies perhaps weren't quite so good at doing everything that they had promised to. But certainly regulators now have toughened things up considerably. And in Europe, there are now very clear legal requirements to do what you've agreed to do. The other thing that is a valid point is that patients will come to harm. Now, I think that one of the things that people don't consider is that when a drug is first licensed, it's gone from a very strictly controlled environment of clinical trials out into the marketplace, and you can get an absolute massive uptake of a drug. I mean, it was rumored that Viagra had something like 100,000 patients taking it in the first week. If you have this sudden increase in usage, if you have a problem with side effect that hasn't been anticipated, you could actually have quite a large number of people affected before you actually could identify it. Now, one of the key things of adaptive pathways is that the patients who are initially exposed are very closely followed up, so that instead of it just being free for everyone to use, these drugs, it's a very controlled niche indication, and the patients are followed up in some form of study. And then the information that you're getting from this more real-world setting is fed back into the totality of information that you're developing about the drug.
Based on that comment, it seems to me that you're suggesting that the observational research can complement the RCT trials that have been conducted. I mean, they've been the gold standard for so many years. Do you see that this standard is being undermined, or how is that changing with the advent of adaptive pathways and observational research?
I think it's a change in attitude. I mean, people have known for years that there are limitations to clinical trials and that you get a lot of the information after a drug is authorized. People have also known that you must do clinical trials. I mean, I think we're never going to get away from the fact you will always have to do clinical trials. I think we will never get away from the fact that clinical trials are the gold standard for proving efficacy. But there is increasing acknowledgement that they won't answer all questions. So what we really need to do is, as you suggest, we need to do a mixture of clinical trials and complement it with real-world evidence. And what I would like to see companies doing is that they look at all the evidence that they need to get. They look and see what questions they need to answer at each stage, and then they plan what is the most effective study design to answer this. And sometimes it will be clinical trials, sometimes it will be real world. It's just a question of getting the best study design to produce the best evidence to answer a particular question.
That's really interesting. Do you think that regulators will also adopt that point of view? I mean, we hear so much about payers and health technology assessment agencies driving demand for real-world data because essentially they're paying for real-world use. But what about the regulators?
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because the driving force behind this has actually been the regulators. Both Health Canada and the European Medicines Agency have been really the prime movers in working with MIT and other stakeholders to move this forward and get the concept of adaptive pathways out there. The EMA has actually had a pilot program using adaptive pathways, which has been going since March 2014. And actually, the people who are most, I would say, reluctant to go along with this are some of the health technology assessment bodies and the payers, because they are very concerned there will not be the amount of evidence that they require. And they are less, in many ways, flexible than the regulators are proving.
And do you see any specific catalysts or barriers to adaptive pathways? For instance, advancement in technology or advanced analytics?
I think probably one of the main catalysts is that drug development is becoming unsustainable. We are now understanding that what we have previously considered to be one disease, in fact, may not be, and that it may be made up of all sorts of subpopulations who actually need different treatment. I mean, the prime example of this is in oncology, where instead of having a drug to, say, treat breast cancer, you are now doing genetic typing of the tumors and fitting the therapy to the genetic profile of the tumor. And I think we are going to increasingly find this with more and more diseases. And then, of course, we have the rare diseases, where there's something like 7,000 rare diseases and only 5% of them have a cure. So you've got the idea that you've got many much smaller target populations. And at the same time, the costs are increasing. So you have to do something about that, because we cannot just carry on the pathway that we're doing. Also, medicine is becoming so much cleverer, and we're discovering all these new pathways and receptors. And so inevitably, there will be more and more treatments that are possible. I think there's also a recognition that pharmacoepidemiology, which is really the science of doing observational studies, is growing in strength and sophistication. A lot of clinical trial people heavily criticize pharmacoepi as not being sufficiently scientifically rigorous. But if you think about it, James Lind in the 1700s was probably the first person to do a clinical trial. So clinical trials have had over 300 years of development. Pharmacoepi really started coming along in about the 1980s. So it's a new science, but it's rapidly developing in strength and sophistication. And thirdly, I think the other driver is patient advocacy. Patients aren't prepared to sit back and wait for a drug to become available. So patients are really wanting to be given the chance to try these new things. If they are willing to take risks and fully understand what they're doing, I think it's only fair that everybody else, the regulators, the payers, and the physicians, give them this opportunity.
You made a couple of critical points there I'd like to follow up on. One is around the methodology. Do you foresee some type of harmonization process for pharmacoepi methods, almost akin to what happened with the RCTs maybe 50 years ago, that will help sort of regulators assess and appraise the methods that are being deployed in observational and maybe even some of these hybrid or pragmatic designs?
Yes, I think there is already quite a lot of work going on in that area. And there's the International Society of Pharmacoepidemiology, who've got good pharmacoepidemiology practices. There's also the European Medicines Agency have got the European Network of Centres of Pharmacovigilance and Pharmacoepidemiology, and they have been developing a methodological guidance which basically takes together best practices from around the world and gives guidance to people on what to employ in what situations. And I think also that pharmacoepi is now an established science, and so you actually have universities that are busy developing new ways of doing things. I mean, you've got things like propensity scoring, which wasn't known about, say, 10, 15 years ago. And these are all ways of trying to get around some of the limitations of pharmacoepidemiology and strengthen their contribution.
Seems like those initiatives that you touch on, as we improve transparent communication of what these are all about and harmonize them, it will help all stakeholders better understand how these types of data can complement the RCT data. Another comment that you made I thought was critical was around the patient perspective, patient advocacy, and their role in adaptive pathways. Can you explain a little bit more how a pharma company can engage with patients to ensure that if they are going to access this accelerated channel to market, they're going to do it in a way that's going to maximize benefit and minimize risk to patients?
I think the first way of doing this would be to talk to patients. Find out what it is that they want and what are the things that are most troubling with their disease. I think another thing, and that is increasingly being done by the regulators, is talking to patients to see what they feel is acceptable in the level of risks. How much uncertainty are they prepared to get? And I think a very good example that I can recount from personal experience was natalizumab. Now, natalizumab was marketed in the United States, and there were then three cases of a very rare condition called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Now, at the time that these cases occurred, this drug was under consideration at the European Medicines Agency, and of course there was a lot of concern as to whether they should actually give a license to this medicine. The EMA consulted with various patient organizations, and the patients said, look, we're the people with the disease. We are the people facing increasing disability. It should be up to us to choose if we are willing to take the risk. And the EMA listened to the patients and concluded that the benefit to risk was positive for the medicine. Now, I think that this is an example of where patients can actually have their voice heard into what's going on. And the European Medicines Agency actually now has patient representatives on nearly all its committees. I think for industry to talk to patients is a little more difficult. In some territories, there is restrictions on the communication between pharmaceutical companies and with patients. I think this is an area where neutral third parties can help in acting as a go-between pharmaceutical companies and actual patients, but also it's a big area where patient organizations can help influence.
And Stella, the EMA has been running their pilot program for about a year. How do you think it's going so far?
Well, they've actually concluded the pilot program. They started off in, actually, it's longer than both of us thought. It's March 2014. They initially had 62 applications from companies wanting to put their medicine into the pilot study. Only 20 reached the first level of discussions. 18 reached the next stage of discussions where the companies actually met with the health technology assessment bodies and with patients and regulators. And at the time that the final report was actually published, it was last year, six medicines had gone forward to joint formal HTA stroke scientific advice, and one had gone to scientific advice alone. No medicine has actually been authorized through this program. So we don't know yet about the success or not, or whether it's actually going to work. I also suspect that there are many more medicines out of initial 18 who may be still going through the process. But it's certainly encouraging there were so many applicants wanting to go into it, and that so many actually reached the stage when they were really having formal discussions.
Well, Stella, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time today and your expert insights. I found it enlightening as always, and I look forward to the next time we can have a conversation about this.
Thanks very much, John.
Well, thank you very much for listening to today's podcast, and thanks again to Stella Blackburn for her interview on adaptive pathways. For more information about this interview and others, please visit our website at quintilesims.com to learn more about Access Point. Thank you.